Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Robert Perry, editor of ConsortiumNews.com, who examines Hillary Clinton's embrace of Republican neoconservative supporters in her campaign to win the White House. Professor Michael Hendricks, who talks about the launch of a National Academy of Sciences study into the health impacts of mountaintop removal coal mining, building on his previous research. And Brian Tashman of People for the American Way, who discusses GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump and Senator Marco Rubio's troubling attendance of an Orlando, Florida event sponsored by anti-LGBTQ extremists. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A significant number of the refugees relocated to an Australian detention camp on the Pacific island of Nauru are victims of assault, sexual, and child abuse, according to a leaked cache of 2,000 incident reports revealed by former Save the Children staffers. Over half of the abuse incidents involved children, who make up only 20% of detention camp residents. The Guardian newspaper, which published the 2,000 incident documents, reported that some of the alleged abuse incidents were perpetrated by security guards. Now the Australian Medical Association has called for an independent inquiry to assess the mental health and living conditions of detainees held at Australia's two offshore detention centres. The centres were established for asylum seekers apprehended at sea as they attempted to enter Australia. Anna Neistat, a senior researcher with Amnesty International, protested that Australia's policy of exiling asylum seekers who arrive by boat is cruel in the extreme. Few other countries go to such lengths to deliberately inflict suffering on people seeking safety and freedom. Amid a global shift in refugee flows, Afghans who fled their nation's war and escaped to Turkey now feel forgotten and discriminated against in their quest to reach safety in the West because of an imperfect asylum system that fast-tracks those fleeing the most urgent, headline-grabbing war. Syrians and Iraqis, who formed the bulk of the stampede of more than 1 million migrants arriving in Europe in 2015, now take priority. In 2013, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees suspended Afghan asylum claims due to a large backlog of cases. Yet from 2013 to 2015, Afghans only accounted for 4% of all asylum cases approved in Turkey. Meanwhile, the Turkish government established a special rule to handle the influx of 2.7 million Syrian refugees who are able to get assistance and authorized to receive work permits. 2 years ago, Afghan refugees led a 52-day protest by setting up an encampment in front of the UN refugee office in Ankara, Turkey. A dozen sewed their lips together and launched a hunger strike, declaring that UN incompetence had deprived them of their fundamental rights. Civilian deaths are now rapidly on the rise in Afghanistan. Still, there is little chance most Afghan refugees can reach Europe, despite the fact that over 175,000 Afghans have filed asylum petitions. The U.S. Justice Department has opened a civil rights investigation into the police killing of a Navajo woman, L'Oreal St. John, in Winslow, Arizona. Body camera video shows police officer Austin Shipley trying to restrain St. John, who was suspected of shoplifting, and pushing her to the ground. Moments later, St. John brandished a small pair of medical scissors, and Shipley shot the 27-year-old Native woman 5 times. In July, Officer Shipley was cleared of any wrongdoing by Maricopa County Attorney Bill Montgomery, who reviewed the case. In response, St. John's family has filed a $10.5 million lawsuit against the city of Winslow. The suit claims Shipley violated the woman's civil rights, and the city ignored Officer Shipley's history of unwarranted aggressive actions while on the job. According to the Guardian newspaper's database of U.S. police killings, there has been a spike of police shootings of Native Americans over the last year. Thus far in 2016, 13 Native Americans have been killed by police. Simon Moya Smith, an Oglala Lakota Native activist, complained it's unfortunate that Native Americans are routinely excluded from this conversation about police killings. We first need to get the cops to see us as human, and hopefully then they won't see themselves as judges, the jury, and executioner. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
After weeks of multiple gaffes and a continuing string of offensive statements, Donald Trump is fading in public opinion polls. Hillary Clinton, despite her own controversies, has been the beneficiary, with voter surveys finding that she's widening her lead in key battleground states and among many demographic groups. Trump's provocative positions have also had the effect of triggering disaffection among many Republicans. While a growing number of big-name Republicans have refused to support Trump, many have also taken the additional step of pledging their support to Clinton. Among that group are prominent neoconservatives, who generally advocate the promotion of U.S. interests as they see it through the use of military force. Clinton's neocon supporters include Robert Kagan, co-founder of the neocon think tank Project for the New American Century, that advocated for the Bush administration's decision to unilaterally invade Iraq in 2003. Others include Bush Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage, former GOP National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft, self-declared American imperialist Max Boot, and John Negroponte, Reagan's ambassador to Honduras and Bush ambassador to Iraq, who served as the first director of national intelligence 2005 to 2007. When Hillary Clinton bragged about the praise she received from President Nixon's Secretary of State Henry Kissinger during the February 4th Democratic presidential debate, her then opponent, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, responded by saying that he was proud to say that Henry Kissinger was not his friend and that he would reject advice from Kissinger. Your reporter spoke with investigative journalist Robert Perry, editor of ConsortiumNews.com, who examines Hillary Clinton's embrace of neoconservative supporters and what it may predict about her administration's foreign policy if she should win the presidency this November.
Hillary Clinton, who has had a long history as a very hawkish politician, supporting the Iraq War, not just in 2002 when she voted for it, but really until about 2006, when it became a huge burden on her political ambitions if she wanted to run against and get the Democratic nomination in 2008. So she only really dropped her support for the Iraq War because of political needs. It wasn't as much that she felt it was wrong, and she later, according to Secretary of Defense Gates, in his memoir, she even told President Obama in 2009 that the only reason that she and others opposed the so-called surge in Iraq was for political reasons. She's taken these very hawkish positions, both before she ran for president, and then as Secretary of State, she adopted many of the more aggressive positions, often going against President Obama, who was more reluctant to expand or to continue some of these military adventures. She sided often with the hawks inside his administration. She opposed him really on his efforts in even 2010 to work out a deal with the Iranians on their nuclear program. Obama had reached out to the president of Brazil and the prime minister of Turkey to have them arrange for the Iranians to surrender much of their nuclear enriched uranium. And it was Hillary Clinton who sabotaged that arrangement. She was again taking the side of the neocons who wanted to bomb Iran, or at least continue to escalate those tensions. So she's had this position. She also joined with the hawks in 2009 pushing Obama into escalating the Afghan war, which Obama was very hesitant to do. He initially raised some of the troop levels when he came in, but then was hesitant to go to a counterinsurgency program, which she supported, along with General Petraeus and Defense Secretary Gates, to sort of potentially holdovers from the Bush years. So she continuously took these hawkish stances, and that has won her the support of many key neocons, some of whom have abandoned the Republican Party, people like Robert Kagan, who was one of the co-founders of the Project for the New American Century, pushing for the invasion of Iraq even in the 1990s, and then continuing on into when it finally happened under President George W. Bush. So she's won their support because they feel that of the various choices, she is the best vessel, as it was put in one New York Times article, the best vessel to carry their ambitions forward.
From Hillary Clinton's record in the U.S. Senate and as Secretary of State under President Obama, what are some of your big concerns about what foreign policy a Clinton presidency might pursue?
Well, she indicated during the last debate with Senator Sanders, it's probably the best time to look at what she was staking out for her foreign policy, and it was very aggressive, it was very hawkish. It was neoconservative. For instance, her position on Libya has remained very hawkish. Her position regarding Syria is to intervene more directly militarily. Her position vis-a-vis the Palestinians is to take a very staunch pro-Israeli position, regardless of what the Israelis are up to. Regarding the Russians, she has indicated a willingness to be much more aggressive vis-a-vis President Putin. So she's taken hawkish positions, and she hasn't indicated that she's modified them. So one has to assume that they still are her positions.
It's been the track record of the U.S. peace movement after recent presidential elections where Democrats won the White House that peace activists generally have gone to sleep. They've gone into a deep, deep coma and not come out of the woodwork to protest or pressure the government in any way on their foreign policy choices. We've seen that under Bill Clinton, and we certainly have seen that under President Obama. What's the outlook for the peace movement if you have a hawkish President Hillary Clinton in office?
Well, it's a good question, Scott. One thing I have written about is the potential for the Democratic Party to splinter, because you had the experience of the late 1960s, early 1970s, when there was a stronger peace movement. And over the Vietnam War, and there was a break within the Democratic Party over whether to support a more peaceful approach to that as some kind of negotiated settlement, or to continue the warfare. So I think there's a danger here that if Hillary Clinton does win the presidency and she does carry out a sort of neoconservative foreign policy, what will the peace element of the Democratic Party do? Will it continue to kind of, as you say, soft pedal these complaints? Concerns and trying to make excuses for the Democrats if they expand or perpetuate these war policies. It's hard to say because obviously we don't know what the future holds, but that is a potential danger for the Democratic Party if Hillary Clinton governs along the lines of what she has advocated in terms of foreign policy.
That was investigative journalist Robert Perry, editor at ConsortiumNews.com. Find links to recent articles on Hillary Clinton's embrace of neoconservative supporters by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. It was recently announced that the National Academy of Sciences will undertake a study of the health impacts of surface coal mining in West Virginia, with a focus on mountaintop removal, in which the tops of mountain ridges are blasted off to extract the coal seams beneath. Residents of communities near mountaintop removal mining sites have long complained about air and water pollution, resulting, they say, in severe health impacts, such as increased risk of cancer, birth defects, and premature death. Area citizens have been organizing support for a federal law called the Appalachia Community Health Emergency Act, or AHCE Act, which would end the permitting of new mountaintop removal sites until thorough health studies could be conducted to provide evidence that the mining practice doesn't threaten public health. The request for the National Academy of Sciences study was made by West Virginia's longtime Secretary of Environmental Protection, Randy Huffman, whom activists had considered hostile to their concerns, and the relatively new state public health commissioner, Rahul Gupta, who had a reputation as a defender of public health. Their request was based largely on research by Professor Michael Hendricks, who conducted health studies for years while at West Virginia University. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Hendricks, now a professor in the Department of Applied Health Science in the School of Public Health at Indiana University, about the work he's done to highlight the health risks of mountaintop removal coal mining and what he hopes a new study will accomplish.
It is kind of a long trail of research. It started with some fairly relatively simple kind of quick and easy secondary data analyses that we could do with available databases that we had. So we just looked at associations between where people were living, some of them in mining environments and some not, and health outcomes that sometimes were based on self-reported health surveys, sometimes on mortality data from the CDC, and finding those kinds of associations. We could control for other variables as well as we could, so we could control statistically for things like age and smoking and poverty and a bunch of other kind of usual suspects, so to speak.
The CDC, that's the Centers for Disease Control.
And they have publicly available mortality data that we've used as one of our data sources to look at relationships between mortality rates and mining. So several of the studies looked at that, and we found higher mortality rates for some types of illnesses, like some types of cancer, including lung cancer, and for chronic forms of heart disease and lung disease, kidney disease. We started with those kinds of associational studies, and then more recently we've been moving into trying to understand more directly what's really happening in the environment, what are the environmental conditions in these mining communities, and what are the potential health consequences of exposure to what's in the environments. So we've collected some air sampling, water sampling, and we've published papers that have shown that the levels of dust or particulate matter in the air are higher in the mining communities compared to control sites. We've shown that the chemical composition of this dust is pretty complicated. It probably comes from a variety of direct mining constituents as well as some of the indirect effects from the industrial activity. But it is high, among other things, it's high in silica. Silica is known to be a lung carcinogen and to promote the development of lung disease. And that is one of the most consistent health effects that we've seen. Lung cancer, COPD, other chronic forms of respiratory disease are clearly elevated in these communities. If you just take one study or another study in isolation, any one study by itself is not necessarily that powerful or convincing. But when you look across the body of evidence, you get, a very powerful pattern that shows that there are really health problems in these communities that are not because of poverty or smoking or obesity or age or the other things that the mining industry sometimes tries to blame it on, that we have solid evidence that the environmental conditions really are impaired in these communities compared to control communities, and that there are effects on biological tissues related to what is in these environments. We don't have a single definitive study that links the mining activity to what gets into humans and to the health consequences for those same people. That type of definitive single study is very expensive to do, very time-consuming. You know, I haven't had the resources to try to do it. See, we have to always have a little bit of doubt and introduce a caveat here and there, but I think when you look at the entire body of evidence that it's pretty strong, that this activity is harmful to human health, it is harmful to community health for the people that live in these environments, and even if we don't understand all of the exact biological mechanisms or all of the exact exposures that people face, to try to say, well, we don't know enough, I think is irresponsible at this point and immoral, and that appropriate steps should be taken to eliminate mountaintop removal. I think the evidence, not only for its public health harm, but for its environmental harm, are too strong to ignore, and that this form of mining should be stopped.
Professor Michael Hendricks, what impact do you think the Organizing for the Appalachian Community Health Emergency, or AIC Act, had on this development?
Yeah, I think it did. I mean, I'm just guessing based on my observations and what I've seen. But yeah, I think some of the activist efforts have been pretty visible, pretty vocal. The AIC Act is one good example of that, and other community protests that have taken place.
In your opinion, does this request for a study represent a change in attitude by officials in West Virginia about whether this is a problem or not?
Potentially, you know, I'm not going to draw any conclusions yet until I see exactly what they're asked to do, because I haven't seen the language of what they want that review to be. I don't know who exactly is going to be on the review panel. And even though it's the National Academy of Science, which has a great reputation, I want to just wait and see who the individuals are who are involved in it. But with those caveats, I am cautiously optimistic that this is a change in attitude and that maybe they're going to start to take this more seriously.
That was Michael Hendricks, professor at Indiana University's Department of Applied Health Science in the School of Public Health. Learn more about the research into the health impacts of mountaintop removal coal mining by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On August 11th, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump and Florida GOP Senator Marco Rubio attended an event sponsored by the group American Renewal Project that featured some of the nation's most extreme anti-gay conservative Christian activists. The event, titled Rediscovering God in America, took place in Orlando, Florida, on the eve of the second-month anniversary of the Pulse LGBT nightclub massacre, where a lone gunman shot and killed 49 people and wounded 53 others. Speakers at this gathering have declared that AIDS is a God-given punishment against homosexuality, compared gay activists to terrorists, and warned that marriage equality threatened the utter destruction of our nation. The organizer of the Orlando event, David Lane, was quoted as saying in 2013 that God would punish America over the appearance of a gay poet and a pro-gay rights priest at President Obama's January 2013 inauguration. Your reporter spoke with People for the American Way's senior research analyst Brian Tashman, who discusses the Republican Party's ongoing culture war battle against gay rights and the disturbing message sent by Trump and Rubio's attendance at this anti-LGBT Orlando event.
Rediscovering God in America is an event that we've seen held in a number of states, typically swing states or early primary states, where an activist by the name of David Lane, he's not a pastor, he's a political operative, organizes meetings between pastors and candidates for office. So we have seen people like Mike Huckabee, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, and Marco Rubio, actually, during the presidential race, attend these events. And this Orlando event was organized and happened to coincide with exactly 2 months after the Pulse nightclub shooting. It was organized as well by David Lane, who told Bloomberg News that this would be a good opportunity for the candidates to talk about the threat of, in his words, homosexual totalitarianism. So he really wanted Donald Trump to speak about the supposed threat the LGBT rights movement presents to American freedoms. Other speakers at the event include Matthew Staver, who became very well known when he represented Kentucky clerk Kim Davis, and he actually criticized the Orlando nightclub attack memorials because he called them homosexual love fests. He is somebody who claims that gay people are actually demonic, akin to terrorists and pedophiles. He also believes that President Obama is trying to have forced homosexuality, in Matt Staver's words. Another speaker goes by the name of Ken Graves, who claims that militant homofascism, again, his quote, is working to create a secular humanist caliphate here in America. So we see some very radical activists attending this event alongside Donald Trump and Marco Rubio. And what they really want to do is keep the Republican Party close to the religious right in their agenda, whether it's opposition to abortion rights or continued hostility to LGBT equality.
Brian, suss out for us, if you would, Donald Trump's views as he's articulated it since the primary campaign and now in the general election campaign on gay rights. There's been some portrayal of him, especially during his remarks and his acceptance speech at the Republican National Convention, that he's somehow more moderate than a lot of people within the Republican Party. But
there were very extreme statements within the Republican Party platform that took quite a different view of gay rights.
Absolutely. As you pointed out quite correctly, the Republican Party platform is the most conservative they've ever adopted, even more conservative than the one they adopted 4 years ago, which the platform committee members hailed at the time as the most conservative. It included one plank which subtly criticized laws which prevent parents from taking children to ex-gay therapists. That was among one of many other ultra-conservative planks in the platform. And Donald Trump is often portrayed as a moderate on social issues, mainly because he's waffled so much on them. He said abortion rights are okay, and then he said he was against them, then he said we shouldn't change the abortion rights laws, then he said he wants to ban it again. On gay rights, he's attended same-sex couples' weddings, he has expressed some openness towards marriage, but at the end of the day, what he says doesn't so much matter than the policies he takes. You know, we talk about the evolution, the majority of Americans are becoming more open-minded to gay rights. Donald Trump is the rare person who's actually moving far to the right. Originally, he criticized North Carolina's anti-LGBT HB2 law, and now he says he supports North Carolina's HB2 law. He originally criticized Kim Davis, the clerk who refused to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples following the Supreme Court Obergefell ruling, and now he says that he supports individuals who are trying to defy the Supreme Court. The best example of why Donald Trump would be a president hostile to LGBT rights would be his appointments to the federal judiciary. He has pledged to outsource the entire judicial nominating process to two groups, the Heritage Foundation and the Federalist Society. These are two of the most conservative groups in Washington, D.C. He will be handing over all of his judicial appointments to these far-right anti-gay organizations. And as we've learned, whether on marriage equality, on so many other social issues, a lot of these battles are decided in the courts.
That was People for the American Way's senior research analyst, Brian Tashman. Learn more about the Republican Party's alliance with religious extremists opposing gay rights by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.